Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. My special guest this week is Michelle Chostadovsky, an award-winning author, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Ottawa, and Director of the Centre for Research on Globalisation in Montreal, Quebec. He's the author of The Globalisation of Poverty and The New World Order, published in 2003, and America's War on Terrorism, published in 2005. Michelle is also the co-editor of The Global Economic Crisis, published in 2010. He's a contributor to the Encyclopaedia Britannica, and his writings have been published in more than 20 languages. From October the 12th to the 15th, 2010, Michelle Chostadovsky had several extensive and productive meetings with Fidel Castro discussing nuclear war. Michelle Chostadovsky joins me now on the line from Montreal, Quebec. Welcome to the program, Michelle.
I'm absolutely delighted to be on the program, particularly focusing on the issue of nuclear war, which of course is, I think, crucial at this juncture in our history.
Yes, you know, recently I did an interview with a fellow called Greg Mello, who's following what's going on at Los Alamos Labs, where they're about to build a $6 billion facility to create more nuclear weapons pits out of plutonium for a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, if you please. And all the arms control groups now in Washington, including my own that I founded, Physicians for Social Responsibility, are going along with this in order for the Senate to pass the New START Treaty. So things are grim, and I don't quite know where to turn, and that's why I was so thrilled when I saw, Michelle, that you had met with Castro and he talked specifically about nuclear war. How did you arrange your four-day meeting with Fidel Castro?
Well, Fidel actually is an astute reader of our website, Global Research, so he was familiar with our writings. And I had contact with the Center for Research on the Global Economy in Havana, and I put forth a proposal focusing on the issue, on the broad issues of war and nuclear war, but essentially the very dangerous situation which exists now in the Persian Gulf, and this proposal was accepted. They invited me. I lectured at the university and various other venues, and then in the second week, I had meetings with Fidel Castro. In fact, I didn't expect that we would meet for more than a couple of hours, and I had a cameraman with me who came from Montreal, so we filmed part of these conversations. In fact, the meetings were stretched over four days, so that we met for several hours on each day. We had private conversations, and then we recorded the interview, which is still in preparation. And then on the last day, we filmed a short video clip which Fidel read. It's a very strong statement, which was then broadcast on YouTube, and it was broadcast throughout Latin America. Very little coverage of this statement in the Western media. In fact, I would say no coverage in the Western media. There was coverage in Spanish and Portuguese, and that's about it. And well, in China, Russia, they covered it, but But ultimately, not a word, not even a negative comment. It was simply a whitewash.
Yes.
Should I read that statement?
You should, but does he speak English, Michelle?
Well, he reads English. And I understand that many years ago he did an interview, but that was 30 years ago. He did an interview with on network television in the United States, but he reads. He was reading Bob Woodward's book when I came in, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he said, "Oh, I want to get Mandela's, Mandela's book." And so he ordered Mandela's book. So he's an absolute bookworm. He goes through them in a few hours. He's read through it, and he draws some very important implications. And I asked him the question. I said, "Is the issue of nuclear war more important than the Cuban Revolution?" And he said, "Of course it is."
You were interpreted? You had an interpreter, did you?
No, I speak fluent Spanish.
Oh,
where everything was. I've lived in Latin America. I've taught in Chile and in Argentina.
How fantastic!
And so everything was in Spanish. All my presentations at the university in Spanish. So, and he actually, before I met him, he got a videotape of my lecture at the university, and made a comment which was then printed in all the major newspapers, so that when I met him, we already, in a sense, we knew each other. Although I'd never met him previously, but his statement is very important.
Yes, and I want you to read it.
Okay, so this is the statement he made.
He is Fidel Castro.
And this is the statement by Fidel Castro against nuclear war, and it reads as follows: "The use of nuclear weapons in a new world war would mean the end of humanity. This was candidly foreseen by scientist Albert Einstein, who was able to measure their destructive capability to generate millions of degrees of heat, which would vaporize everything within a wide radius of action. This brilliant researcher had promoted the development of this weapon so that it would not become available to the genocidal Nazi regime. Each and every government in the world has the obligation to respect the right to life of each and every nation and of the totality of the peoples on the planet. Today, there is an imminent risk of war with the use of that kind of weapon, and I don't harbor the least doubt that an attack by the United States and Israel against the Islamic Republic of Iran would inevitably evolve towards a global nuclear conflict. The world's people have an obligation to demand of their political leaders their right to live. When the life of humankind, of your people and your most beloved human beings, runs such risk, nobody can afford to be indifferent. Not one minute can be lost in demanding respect for that right. Tomorrow it will be too late." Albert Einstein himself stated unmistakably, "I do not know with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones." We fully comprehend what he wanted to convey, and he was absolutely right. Yet in the wake of a global nuclear war, there would not be anybody around to make use of those sticks and stones. There would be collateral damage, as the American political and military leaders always affirm, to justify the deaths of innocent people. In a nuclear war, the collateral damage would be the life of all humanity. And then he completes and says, "Let us have the courage to proclaim that all nuclear or conventional weapons, everything that is used to make war, must disappear."
Right. Well, what are we going to do, Michelle?
Well, There's another thing he said to me, which I think it was that when he gave me his book, which was the book on the Cuban Revolution, which is brought out as two volumes. It's a whole narrative of what happened in the course of overthrowing the Batista regime in the late 50s. But he said he used the term to make the impossible possible. In other words, the campaign against nuclear war seems to be an impossibility because we have silence of the media. It's not an issue. It's not being discussed in the newspapers. If it is discussed, it's on page 23 in a small column next to the classifieds. It never makes the front page. But what does make the front page is the use of nuclear weapons against Iran or against any other country on humanitarian grounds. In other words, the preemptive nuclear doctrine. And I think what we have to do is to dismantle this inquisitorial doctrine, which turns realities totally upside down, which presents us with a pack of lies, telling us that nuclear weapons are harmless to the surrounding civilian population, which is part of the Pentagon doctrine, and eventually undo and destroy this consensus. It is a consensus in favor of nuclear war. What bothers me as well is that when this statement was released, we didn't get much response even from non-nuclear states or even from China or Russia. I have contacts with the Russian media. They call me every other week, and I brought this to their attention, and they didn't think it was really newsworthy. They had their eyes focused on other things like the WikiLeaks, which is, of course, very important. But the issue of nuclear war is not front page news. And unfortunately, the other superpowers, Russia and China, do not consider it front page news either. So we're really in a situation where we have to ultimately destroy that consensus. And I think that Fidel Castro's statement is precisely in that direction. It's a humanitarian statement. It's a political statement, but it's broadly a humanitarian statement because he understands that if we don't dismantle these nuclear weapons, if we don't change the military doctrine which sustains them, We are in a World War III scenario, and I think increasingly we realize that this is a distinct possibility, and the future of humanity is threatened.
Yes, Michelle, I've been saying this for what, 30 years or 40 years?
I know.
And I helped to lead the movement actually globally in the 80s, and you know, by the end of 5 years of me talking and luckily getting on television everywhere with the help of a Hollywood agent, 80% of Americans were acutely aware of the medical effects of nuclear war, and it would mean the end of all humanity, let alone the Europeans, the British, the Canadians, the Russians, everyone. And finally, Gorbachev heard the description of the medical effects of nuclear war, and I met with Reagan, and we were able to help to bring about the end of the Cold War, but alas, not the end of nuclear weapons. You know, the thing is, Michelle, I'm 72, and as you talk, I think, oh my God, you know, fancy starting the whole campaign again, which is absolutely imperative. I agree with you. But what the hell are we going to do? What are we going to do? I mean, do we get Fidel Castro on Fox?
Well, I think we have to understand that breaking a consensus is a collective process. It has to be based on changing public opinion in a very massive way.
Yep.
I think what you suggested, that during the Cold War, in a sense, people were a little bit more rational, and they saw the danger, and they saw the danger because military doctrine was based on deterrence, on mutually assured destruction, and concepts which were accepted by both sides. It was accepted by both sides that a nuclear war would lead to the destruction of human life on a massive scale. But in the wake of the Cold War, and particularly in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, the whole nuclear doctrine has been redefined, and the nuclear weapon is no longer a deterrent. It's part of what the Pentagon calls the toolbox. The toolbox is the mix of weapon systems, and then you go and pick and choose which one is, quote, more effective, more efficient to reach certain goals. And I think it was 2002 or 2003 that the U.S. Senate redefined or reclassified nuclear weapons, particularly tactical nuclear weapons. And they said that tactical nuclear weapons could be used in the conventional war theater. Now, these so-called mini nukes have an explosive capacity between one-third and six times the Hiroshima bomb. They are bona fide nuclear weapons in terms of their impact on human life. But nonetheless, I followed the debate in the last few years. But nonetheless, they can now be used without any kind of permission from the commander in chief. They can be used in the war theater. And that is a strictly military decision, which is taken by central command, if we're talking about the Middle East. And it's scary because the military manuals will say, the B-6111, I believe that's the name of these bunker buster bombs with nuclear warheads. Well, the B-6111 is, quote, harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground. That goes into the military manuals. Then the three-star general reads the military manuals and comes to the conclusion that these tactical nuclear weapons are different from the strategic thermonuclear bombs, and they are reclassified. And it's a bit like changing the label on a cigarette pack. Smoking is good for your health. The nuclear bomb now is redefined as good for your health, and consequently we can go ahead and use it. And that is the whole ideology behind them. We have to break a consensus, and lies ultimately are very fragile because the truth will prevail. And that is what
if we don't blow ourselves up in the interim. I'm interviewing Michelle Chosadovsky, an award-winning author, the Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Ottawa. But, Michelle, the point you just made is, they've said we can use, tactical nuclear weapons in the normal theatre of war, etc., etc. And that doctrine did come out in 2002 with the new defence guidance plan. But also, let's be frank, they still have the mutually assured destruction doctrine. They still have launch on warning, launch under attack. But also, there are thousands of hydrogen bombs in missiles on hair trigger alert, which can be launched, with a 3-minute decision time by Putin or Obama. And let's be frank, it may be Sarah Palin's fair finger that is on the trigger in 2 years' time. So it's not just the tactical nuclear weapons. It's and I kid you not, I think that's a distinct possibility. It's the threat of, immediate, within an hour, global annihilation. I honour Fidel Castro for looking at at the global situation and not worrying so much about Cuba at this stage. And I would love to see him and talk to him. Certainly, we've got to have a new approach, I think.
You're absolutely right as far as the issue of the so-called strategic nuclear weapons. That threat is still there. But the reason why I refer to the tactical is that the statements which are being made now by both President Obama and Hillary Clinton pertain to the use of the tactical nuclear weapons against Iran. Okay. And they're not saying we're going to use thermonuclear bombs against Iran. That maybe they're keeping that for the Russians and the Chinese.
But the tactical weapons are thermonuclear bombs. They're small hydrogen bombs.
Yes.
They are.
Yeah, they are. They're just smaller. Is that not the distinction?
Yeah.
It's the delivery system.
It's the delivery system that is the distinction. If a tactical nuclear weapon is not one on a missile, an intercontinental missile that travels from thousands of miles, it's either in a plane that's dropped from a plane, or it's ground launched from a launcher, or a man walks into battle with the launcher on his shoulder. It's called a Davy Crockett. When the bomb explodes, he gets vaporized too. So the distinction is only the method of delivery. It's not that it's not a hydrogen bomb. They all are now, practically.
Yeah. Well, but I understand that the tactical nuclear weapons have a much smaller explosive
they do.
Capacity.
Yeah, that, as you pointed out, they can be ramped up by a dial from, you know, one-third the size of the Hiroshima bomb, which was 13 kilotons or 13,000 tons of TNT equivalent, to six times that size, which is a reasonably big bomb. Let's talk about Iran. I want your whole philosophical, political take on what's happening with Iran at the moment, Michel Chosedovsky.
Well, I think that what's happening is that there's a massive military buildup in the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Sea, but also in the Eastern Mediterranean.
By whom?
Well, by the United States and its allies. So it's the U.S.-NATO alliance. Israel is also part of that alliance.
They got aircraft carriers and battleships?
Well,
and
now
what
the most recent, report that we published actually yesterday is the massive it's the massive buildup in the Arabian Sea, where you have several nuclear powered supercarrier. Aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
The Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
The U.S. Harry S. Truman carrier strike group.
Yeah.
Then you have a bunch of French warships, the Charles de Gaulle of the French Navy, joining their U.S. counterparts. This kind of concentration of naval power in the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea is not unusual. It's routine.
Mm.
But on the other hand, we're seeing in turn, together with this process, with this military buildup, we're seeing these massive arms sales to two countries. One is Saudi Arabia, $60 billion of U.S. Military hardware. Which includes, of course, fighter bombers and so on. The other country is India. Now, if you look at the map, you'll see that Saudi Arabia and India are on opposite sides of the Arabian Sea, and the geopolitics of this whole region is, of course, absolutely crucial. Saudi Arabia is the major military power with borders on the Persian Gulf, right opposite Iran, okay?
Yeah.
And of course, you have the Emirates. All that whole area is militarized. And then now this recent shift in America's relationship to India is very important because I think essentially what they want to trigger is a war against Pakistan. That war is practically de facto because it's undeclared, but you have these drone attacks in the tribal areas of northern Pakistan, and the last most recent information I received actually in a press report this week was that an actual invasion of Pakistan, a U.S. invasion of Pakistan, actually is from an Australian source. It was published in The Australian yesterday morning.
I missed that.
It was a statement by MP Bob Catter.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't trust Bob Catter as far as I could kick him. He's a semi.
Yeah. Well,
he's
well,
an aberrant
maybe he,
character.
Maybe you can. Maybe that's a correct statement, but I can. But he's. It's not the. He's,
oh, I
he's
wouldn't take
other
him.
Sources.
No, I wouldn't take him seriously at all, Michelle.
Yeah,
no.
But I mean the United States is at war with Afghanistan, and now we have the AFPAC war. We have a massive. We have massive arms trade agreements with India and Saudi Arabia, which suggests that the United States is anxious to make these countries fight on their behalf. They're part of the broader NATO alliance.
But what are they going to fight about? Do they want to go into Iran and get the oil? Is that basically what it's about? As was the Iraqi situation?
I think the ultimate objective is to destabilize Iran, which controls something of the order of 10% of global oil reserves. It has massive gas reserves, some of the largest in the world, or the second largest in the world. And there's a whole history behind it because this was a colony of British Petroleum, the so-called Anglo-Persian Oil Company.
Yep.
So that if you go back to military documents of the mid-90s, strategic documents of the United States, Central Command, it's very clearly stipulated that the first objective is Iraq and the second is Iran. And that was in terms of theater operations. It wasn't simply a rhetorical statement. And so that the war on Iran has been on the drawing board of the Pentagon for years now. I've been following it for at least 5 or 6 years, and I can say unequivocally that since 2003, there have been plans to bomb Iran and even to invade Iran. Some of the first scenarios after the war on Iraq emerged, I believe it was in the summer of 2003, where they started with exercises which were called Tyrant. Now, Tyrant stands for Theater Iran Near Term. Subsequently, they had other exercises. I can't recall the name of the subsequent exercises, but what was very interesting is that they had fictitious names of fictitious countries, and it was very clear what these countries were. It was Irmingham, Rubeck, Churia, Nemesis, so essentially Irmingham stands for Iran, Rubeck stands for Russia, Churia stands for China, and Nemesis stands for North Korea. Okay.
So what do these war games involve?
Well, they essentially were simulations of what would happen. Well, it was based on targeting Irmingham, and then looking at what Churia and Rubeck would do, who are allies of Irmingham.
Oh.
So that this was leaked to the Washington Post, actually, these war games. And so we have a hint of what they're really like. But
Michelle Chizadovsky, you think that this whole rubric of animosity towards Iran now is still about the oil. And I want to remind the audience that there was a wonderful leader of Iran called Mossadegh. And the people just loved him. He used to appear on his balcony in his pajamas and they just adored him. He was deposed by British Petroleum and American oil companies. And then they put in the Shah of Iran, who really worked with the CIA and was a really, really cruel dictator with the police force called SAVAK. And then he was deposed by Ayatollah Khomeini, who lived in Paris, but who organized the revolution with audio tapes that he sent from Paris. And that turned on the people, got the people going in Iran. And then the American hostage crisis occurred. And then now we've got Ahmadinejad, who is a bit nutty, to say the least, I suppose. But there's a tremendous turmoil within Iran. And Iran is much, much, much larger than Iraq, right? And with a huge military force, Michel Jazadovsky.
Well, that's correct. I mean, Iran has a population of over 60 million people.
Yep.
It is, by all accounts, is a regional power. It has significant military capabilities. It has very significant conventional forces.
Yep.
It does not have nuclear weapons. There's absolutely no evidence to the fact that it has any intentions of.
Well, we might. We don't absolutely know that. They could develop nuclear weapons, but at the moment, the International Atomic Energy Agency, etc., say they don't. Right?
Yeah, well, I think that if the Atomic Agency says they don't, and there's been a lot of debate on that, but essentially, I think that is, in a sense, a red herring,
yeah.
Because what they want to do is to find a pretext,
yep,
to wage a war, either to wage a war on them or to have them implement some kind of regime change which would involve giving up their position as a regional power and integrating into the U.S. sphere of influence. Now, some people have said that really what is at stake is the battle for Eurasia, that Eurasia is the biggest landmass. It's a whole continent, and it has a number of regional powers, of which China, Russia, and Iran are the main
what?
Ones.
And you're implying that America's got a plan to take over Eurasia?
No, America has a plan, and that's already been outlined in U.S. congressional documents, to establish a sphere of U.S. interest in which extends from the Middle East and Central Asia to the Far East. Okay. It's the Eurasian corridor. It's not a plan necessarily of conquest, but certainly, if you look at what's going on now today, you have two or three distinct war theaters. But you have Iraq, you have Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they attack, if there's any kind of an attack on Iran by U.S. and allied forces, immediately we will see that whole region exploding,
yeah,
from the eastern Mediterranean to the Chinese border. We're no longer talking about separate war theaters. Iran has borders with Iraq. It has borders with Afghanistan. It would immediately, most probably, send in troops into across the border of those two countries, focusing or attacking U.S. military facilities. They can mobilize several million conventional forces overnight. One thing which emerged in my discussions with Fidel, and I think it corroborated by many other by a lot of research on this issue, is that the U.S. and its allies cannot win a conventional war in that region. And they certainly cannot win a conventional war against Iran, so that they may, in fact, use nuclear weapons they would throw nuclear weapons into the balance, so to speak. They would be obliged to shift into a nuclear weapons strategy, because in conventional warfare they are at a significant disadvantage. I'm not saying the significant disadvantage necessarily, they still will prevail, but whether they're able to win a war in that region, that is a big question. And it's a big question today in relation to Iraq, which has a resistance movement. If they go into Iran with 2 million conventional, very well-trained conventional forces, even if they have a military superiority, will they be able to come to terms with a country of 60 million people with several million armed forces, where there's conscription, you know, universal conscription, and so on and so forth? I think that what we're in for is a scenario of escalation, and in a scenario of escalation, that's when people start thinking of using nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and become irrational. I'm interviewing Michelle Chazadovsky, an award-winning author, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Ottawa. As you speak, Michelle, I wonder who is behind this philosophy, this thinking, this irrational rationale for the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iran. Is it the huge corporations who want more and more oil to feed the cars and to feed, you know, our lifestyle? Or is the military primarily responsible for establishing these policies? Are the politicians just being dragged along, or are they primarily responsible for these policies? Where do you think this crazy thinking comes from?
Well, this is a very complex question. This is definitely a corporate agenda. It's not. It translates into a political and military agenda, but the major interests are the oil companies, the so-called defense contractors, what we might call the military-industrial complex, the Wall Street banks, the certainly the financial institutions, because they are the people who lend the money to finance the wars. The biotech conglomerates have significant interests. They produce chemical weapons, biological weapons. They overlap with the military-industrial complex. The large mercenary companies, the construction companies that are picking up the pieces in the war theater and getting big contracts. It is a corporate agenda. There's no question about it. It is a corporate agenda. But it interfaces with very powerful think tanks, such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission. It has links in the universities, in the Washington Research Institute, and then this interfaces, of course, with the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies, and so on. But conversely, I mean, many of these state entities, such as the CIA, are also on Wall Street. They're also partners of the military-industrial complex. And I would say that this is predominantly, or at least it was until recently, an Anglo-American project, which was based on the integration of defense contractors, both in the United Kingdom and the United States, particularly British Aerospace System Corporation, which now has the status of the same status as the Big Five. It's recognized as a U.S.-based company which can participate in defense procurement contracts.
Who are the Big Five?
The Big Five are Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon.
Boeing,
General Dynamics, but I think we might extend the Big Five. There's also the Halliburtons and the Blackwaters and so on. I mean, there's a whole string of companies. This whole sector has expanded tremendously in the last decade, particularly since the war in Yugoslavia. But it's big bucks. Now, if there's a $60 billion trade in weapons with Saudi Arabia, who is behind it? Well, the military contractors in the United States. It's contract for them. They sell fighter bombers, whatever. But it's also a way of recycling Saudi oil revenues to the Wall Street banks. Because Saudi Arabia is going to use its oil revenues to buy weapons. Yeah. So it's a circular process. Now, we must also understand that there's another element in this whole framework is the importance of the drug trade. The drug trade is also the trade in narcotics. Afghanistan is the number one producer in the world of grade 4 heroin. It produces 93% of the world's supply of heroin, which represents revenues of something of the order of more than $200 billion a year. Most of it, of course, accruing outside of Afghanistan. So there's also that other aspect of the global drug trade. It's linked to intelligence agencies.
Oh,
it's
my
linked
God.
To weapons production and so on.
Go on.
No, well, that's
well,
for the moment.
Michelle, recently I read a report, and I sort of subliminally, I suppose, thought this was possible, but about the enormous mineral riches in Afghanistan. I just thought it was a tremendously bare, barren desert country, you know, inhabited by tribal people that have been there forever and who are very powerful in their own right. But I was not aware of the extraordinary mineral riches there. Would you like to enlarge upon that?
Yeah. Well, those minerals Afghanistan is very wealthy in minerals and also oil, actually. It's natural gas. But there's some very important strategic minerals which are there in Afghanistan.
Rare earths, aren't they?
Pardon?
Rare earths used for computers and cell phones and things
like that. That's correct. Mm. I mean, some of these deposits were known during the Soviet period. They include iron, copper, cobalt. There's a lot of gold. There's lithium, okay, which is mm-hmm. a critical metal, or strategic metal. And the Soviets had already canvassed. They knew where these minerals were, and just a few months ago, there was a report published in the New York Times which acknowledged this vast mineral wealth of Afghanistan.
Yes, that's
but I went through this material, and in fact, it was well known going back to geological surveys of the Soviet period.
Right.
So that when they invaded Afghanistan, they knew farewell that this country was tremendously wealthy in minerals and in natural gas. It was not only a land bridge for the pipeline. We understood that was one of the objectives for invading Afghanistan.
Yes.
And then, of course, it's the drug trade.
Well, Michelle Chazadovsky, would you like to outline the number of bases that the US have built there now and the size of them, the military bases in Afghanistan and the size of the bases?
I don't have exact figures on military, on US military bases in Afghanistan. But there are numerous facilities in Afghanistan.
I think there are 14 major ones. 14 major ones, and the base in Kabul is just vast, absolutely vast. As is the base in Baghdad, which was Saddam Hussein's palace. So they're setting themselves up, you know, to remain obviously permanently. And then the other thing we need to get on to, Michelle, is the nuclear weapons in Pakistan. Now, Pakistan is very unstable at the moment, as we know. the dreadful, dreadful floods, and 20 million people who were affected by the floods with a very inadequate government response. The military, which is very powerful, and I did read that over 50% of the military in Pakistan are the Taliban. And Pakistan has probably 60 to 80 hydrogen bombs now, orchestrated by a man called A.Q. Khan. And so it's possible, and I know the Americans, and particularly President Obama, are acutely aware of this problem, that the Taliban could gain possession of these hydrogen bombs. And one of the reasons put forward, I think, for America's presence in Afghanistan and moving into Pakistan is these nuclear weapons. Would you concur?
Well, I'm not sure where I stand on this debate, because the United States has been really in Pakistan for quite a number of years, going back to the military governments with General Zia,
yeah,
of the early 80s, and in
who
fact,
was a dictator.
Pakistan was intimately tied into the Soviet-Afghan war. It was a launch pad. Its intelligence services were tied into the CIA, that's the Inter-Services Intelligence. The military has collaborated with them. The nuclear program was also supported by the United States. It was supported by other countries, including France. But now there are some reports to the effect that the United States seeks to take control of Pakistan's nuclear program. I'm not sure whether that might be a pretext for justifying military, escalating U.S. military involvement
in
Pakistan.
Well, I mean, I think it's a mishmash. I think it's heterogeneous. I mean, we've got all these incredible minerals in Afghanistan. But the truth is, and a new study has been done by meteorologist Crutzen, Robock et al., to show that if there was a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, it would kill over a billion people and create nuclear autumn, such that there would be such intense smoke covering the northern hemisphere that crops would not be grown and hundreds of millions of people would starve because you couldn't grow any food. This is a really scary scenario, and it's quite recent data. So on top of the United States and the corporations wanting to take over the minerals clearly in Afghanistan and the oil in Iraq and Iran, we've got the sort of tenuous, fragile problem of the ongoing conflict between Pakistan and India. And indeed, some years ago, they got to within days of having a nuclear conflict. So that, in a way, overrides, I suppose, the other issues we've been talking about. And the other thing is that because America and Russia have their weapons on hair trigger alert and computers or false computer signals can trigger an exchange between Russia and America, a nuclear exchange, a limited nuclear war, so to speak, in India and Pakistan could, in fact, trigger the global annihilation that Fidel Castro has been talking about.
But I think what you're mentioning is very much also related to U.S. Military aid to India, because there's also been a big contract. It's not as large as Saudi Arabia, but they're putting in billions of dollars into military aid to India. And they also, at the same time, they have historically supported Pakistan, so that, in effect, what we have is a situation where the United States and its allies are supporting both sides. And through the a military buildup, which they themselves have instigated, they are creating conditions for a conflict between these two countries.
Well, why on earth would the United States do that? I don't understand the rationale.
Well, for the same reason as they triggered a war between Iran and Iraq, it's to weaken two regional powers. India is the second largest country in terms of population on earth. Pakistan is a country of over 150 million people. It's also a regional power. And
but why would they want to weaken them? I don't understand. Why would they want to weaken them?
Well, if they don't want to weaken them, why are they building up their weapon systems on both sides and creating instability on the borders of these two countries? You know, there was a moment just after the fall of the Musharraf regime, there was some sense of rapprochement between India and Pakistan.
Yeah, yeah.
And historically, these two countries have a lot in common. I mean, they culturally and so on. And immediately what happened is that the United States, I think, encroached upon those endeavors. They made the transition towards a democratic government virtually impossible. Well, through what we know, the assassination which took place in a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Yes. And the question is, what is the underlying objective? If the underlying objective is to allow for Pakistan and India to live peacefully together in that region, then why do they need to build up their military when their military is directed against the other country next door?
Well, are you implying that America was involved in the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, Michelle Chazadovsky?
I can't make that statement.
No, I
can't make that statement.
No.
There've been pointers to the Pakistani intelligence services. Some people have said it was sponsored by the CIA. If indeed Benazir Bhutto had been assassinated by on the orders of Pakistani intelligence, this would indirectly imply a complicity on the part of the United States, because they are very close liaisons.
Yeah, but we don't know.
But what we can say is that Benazir Bhutto was not protected in any way in Rawalpindi, which is virtually a military city. It's a suburb of Islamabad, but it's the headquarters of the Pakistani military. The whole place is swarming with military police and so on. And how is it that she wasn't protected? There were accusations directed against the Pakistani military authorities. So in any event, I think what happened is that country was not able to have a transition towards democracy.
Yeah.
Okay,
it was.
There were democratic elections. Then Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. Then her husband was elected.
Yeah.
Today we see that what's at stake for Pakistan is something else. Now I actually brought out a text which was published shortly after Benazir Bhutto's assassination, and I looked into U.S. military documents, and it was worth noting that at the time the United States had already said that Pakistan was a failed nation, that its fate was similar to that of Yugoslavia, that it would break up into small, regional powers. And in fact, then I looked into the fact that the Balochistan Liberation Movement, which is a separatist movement, was, according to parliamentary sources in Pakistan, supported by British intelligence, okay? And so that there was, in a sense, there was a certain similarity between Pakistan on the one hand and Yugoslavia on the other hand, the Balochistan Liberation Army and the KLA. Why? Because they were supported also by Western intelligence. So that I think there was definitely a plan on the part of Washington to promote the political breakup and fragmentation of Pakistan, and the assassination of Benazir Bhutto created conditions which supported that ongoing destabilization.
Well, Michelle, on that pleasant note, and I'm being sarcastic, we have run out of time. I must say that it's what we've covered today is so extremely complex that it's hard for me, let alone most people, I think, to get their heads around it. But if we fail to understand what's happening, I tremble for our planet's survival. And I suppose we go back to the statement that you read initially in the program from Fidel Castro. Anyway, I thank you so much for this interview. It's been very enlightening and fascinating and provocative. And I'm glad I got to know you in Malaysia, Michelle.
Well, I hope that we will be able to reverse the tide.
Yes.
And I think what is much, the geopolitics may be complex, but I think world public opinion can understand the significance of a nuclear war and what
absolutely
it could mean for the future of mankind. That is the message we have to get out.
Yeah, which means we have much work ahead. On If You Love This Planet today, I've been speaking with Michelle Chazadovsky, an award-winning author, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Ottawa. Thanks for listening today. Our website is ifyoulovethisplanet.org, and we'll be with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.